Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Ornstein of Friends of the Earth, who examines the obstacles blocking international action on climate change in the wake of a rising number of severe weather events, including Typhoon Haiyan's recent devastation of the Philippines. Dr. Lily Hamouziadu, with the group Iraq Body Count, who assesses the number of Iraqi deaths in recent months and some theories about why the country has witnessed such a sharp rise in violence. And Margaret Flowers, a Maryland pediatrician and activist, who discusses the troubled first month of the Affordable Care Act that reinforces her advocacy of a Medicare for All universal health care system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The push for comprehensive immigration reform stalled in the House of Representatives as House Speaker John Boehner refused to take up the bipartisan Senate bill to legislate a legal path to citizenship. Meanwhile, the Obama administration continues to deport 400,000 immigrants annually and audits the records of 2,000 businesses a year, searching for a paper trail leading to undocumented workers. Among the nearly 1 million guest workers in the U.S. with temporary visas, some continued to find themselves in working conditions comparable to modern-day slavery. Yet Congress, obsessed with border security, largely ignores the consequences of free trade deals that drive millions of migrants to flee their native countries. According to the news magazine In These Times, cross-border migration globally has increased by 78 million people over the last 20 years, enough to populate 20 cities the size of Los Angeles. The number of native Mexicans immigrating to the U.S. has nearly tripled since the North American Free Trade Agreement came into force in 1994. Global justice activists are now promoting a right-to-stay-home campaign, envisioning migration as voluntary rather than required to survive in the global economy. Amid the brutal civil wars, popular uprisings, and regime change across the Middle East, youthful tech startups and the rise of social media are creating new economic opportunities. With the aid of Western venture capital and other investors, the Arab world is now the hottest market for growth in e-commerce, spiking over 70% since the beginning of 2011, according to the Christian Science Monitor. The Middle East tech boom occurred as the number of Facebook users tripled between 2010 and 2012, driven by Arab Spring uprisings and widespread discontent with authoritarian regimes. However, even with the growth of online engagement, half the people in the Middle East and North Africa don't have access to the internet. Christopher Schroeder, author of Startup Rising, says the youthful tech boom is another result of the Arab Spring that began in Tunisia and spread across the region, fueled by the lack of job prospects for millions of young Arabs. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is on the short list of candidates for the 2016 Republican nomination for president, leveraging his reputation as a bipartisan dealmaker who can attract votes from women, independents, and communities of color. Yet on the matter of the environment and climate, Christie is no moderate. As New Jersey's governor, he's pushed to slash environmental programs, weaken clean water regulations, and left the state's coast vulnerable to the ravages of a future superstorm Sandy. During his first term, Christie pulled New Jersey out of the regional greenhouse gas initiative and cut the state's commitment to renewable energy. In talking with reporters, Christie often dismisses climate change as esoteric theories and a distraction. Jeff Tittle, director of the New Jersey chapter of the Sierra Club, told the online Grist environmental magazine, Christie, on a lot of environmental issues, will step right in line with the Tea Party and the Koch brothers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
While the people of the Philippines work to recover and rebuild lives shattered by Typhoon Haiyan, delegates from around the globe were gathered in Warsaw, Poland, for the United Nations Climate Change Summit. The typhoon that devastated the eastern Philippine islands of Samar, Leyte and Negros on November 8th, was the most powerful storm of its kind ever recorded in world history. It's estimated that almost 4,000 people lost their lives and some 4 million were displaced as a result of the storm. In an emotional speech made before the International Climate Meeting in Poland, Jeb Sano, leader of the Philippines delegation, linked the destruction wrought by Typhoon Haiyan to climate change and pledged to refrain from eating until meaningful progress is made toward an agreement addressing global warming. He told those gathered, quote, "What my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. The climate crisis is madness. We can stop this madness right here in Warsaw," he said. Increasingly, poor nations are bearing the brunt of severe weather events linked to climate change, despite the fact that these countries produce comparatively little carbon and greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming. These governments are becoming ever more vocal in their demand for wealthy industrialized nations to take determined action to reduce their carbon emissions and contribute funds to assist nations to adapt to the planet's changing climate. Your reporter spoke with Karen Ornstein, international policy analyst with the environmental group Friends of the Earth. Here she discusses the obstacles to reaching an international accord on regulating carbon emissions and the damage suffered by developing nations resulting from inaction by industrial nations like the U.S.
You can't attribute a single weather event to climate change in and of itself, but what you can do is attribute a general trend or pattern. And so, you know, climate science tells us that the more our climate changes, the more global temperatures rise, the more extreme weather events there will be. And so you have, for example, in the Philippines, you had this terrible, terrible typhoon like the world has never seen before. And it happened to be at the start of this big climate conference in Poland. But also last year at the start of the same climate conference, that last year it was held in Qatar and Doha, another incredible typhoon, not as strong as this one because nothing can be as strong as that one, but another massive typhoon hit the Philippines. And, you know, I'm from Illinois, actually, and I was really surprised to hear about the weather that occurred there over the weekend, because it's just not normal. So we're seeing, you know, you have wildfires raging in Australia, a new category of typhoons in the Philippines. All of this is predicted by climate science.
Karen Ornstein, after the typhoon struck, the Philippine representative to the UN Climate Summit in Warsaw committed to undertake a fast to focus attention on the urgent need to overcome obstacles to reaching an agreement, which has thus far been pretty elusive for the international community, to both regulate carbon emissions and greenhouse gases. What impact will that fast have, you think, on international action here?
Well, on the one hand, I think it's an incredible symbol and a sign of, you know, leadership by the Philippines. And he's doing this. The negotiator's name is Jeb Sano, and he's doing this with the support of many activists who are fasting in solidarity. And, you know, as he said, it's because his brother hadn't eaten for days because his family is from the area where the typhoon hit, and he wanted to do this in solidarity and to draw the world's attention. So on the one hand, I think it's an important moral move. On the other hand, I don't know if it will have much of an actual impact, because even Jeb Sano himself said he was sort of resigned to the fact that, you know, he's going to do this and all this will happen, but that there might not actually be much change as far as sort of the entrenched positions of a lot of the wealthier countries, not least of which the United States. So the U.S. reaction is, well, you know, it's a terrible tragedy. We're sending humanitarian assistance. It's a terrible tragedy, and we're going to send humanitarian assistance. And also, we need to look at the root causes of climate change and look at our fossil fuel consumption and our way of life. In the places where such reflection needs to happen, it is not likely to happen in those seats of power.
What are the major obstacles, in your view, that is preventing meaningful action by the international community on climate change and regulating carbon emissions and greenhouse gases?
I think the biggest obstacle is money and politics, right? The fossil fuel industry in this country and, you know, their friends on Wall Street and other places very much want to see a continuation of the status quo. It's not just in the industry or the recipients of corporate welfare, it's, you know, their friends in Congress and their friends in the Obama administration. They don't want to see this change that is absolutely critical. And, you know, the biggest obstacles, you know, in a global scale, you know, the United States, Australia, Canada, Japan. I mean, Japan just, you know, announced a decrease in their commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. commitment is a joke. You know, Australia just elected a right-wing government that has not even sent a high-level minister to the climate negotiations. And there's a pattern in these countries, right? Like in Australia, the fossil fuel industry is very strong. In Canada, it is as well. And there's also something to people, for example, in the U.S. being accustomed to a certain level of lifestyle. And I think a lot of it is just, for the United States in particular, our Congress is so dysfunctional. And the way to actually regulate climate change is to regulate, you know, climate pollution through, you know, through laws and things like that and incentives. But when you have really flat Earth Society members of Congress who deny that climate change is actually happening, how are you gonna break through and make progress on even in a small scale? So if we want to start, you know, looking at the causes, we have to start with the United States.
What would be the single most effective thing that our government could do, and obviously that would have influence around the world, to, you know, very forcefully address the issue of climate change? Is there any piece of legislation out there that is a model for what our government could do and what people could pressure our government to do?
I mean, I actually think in the very immediate term, the most important thing to do is for Obama not to give approval to the Keystone XL pipeline to deliver tar sands from Canada to the United States. That would be the single most important act in a very immediate sense. There's been some good pieces of legislation, some not so good pieces of legislation. You know, the actual really good ones have a very small chance of actually becoming law. But I really think it would start with Obama saying no to the Keystone XL pipeline, that, like, point blank.
That was Karen Ornstein, international policy analyst with the environmental group Friends of the Earth. Find links to groups campaigning for action on climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With little attention from U.S. corporate media or Washington politicians, violence has dramatically increased in Iraq since the withdrawal of U.S. troops there at the end of 2012. Suicide bombings and other indiscriminate attacks on both the military and civilians have risen sharply this year, many attributed to militant Sunni groups and or al-Qaeda in Iraq. Iraq's Shiite Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, recently traveled to Washington requesting U.S. support to rein in the violence, even though his exclusion of the Sunni minority from a meaningful role in his government has, according to many observers, contributed to the escalation of violence. Iraq Body Count, a joint project of American and British researchers, was founded shortly before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March 2003 to research the baseline of civilian deaths in the country and calculate the increase once the war began. 10 years later, their grim research continues. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Lily Hamoziadou, a British-based news collector and recent events editor with Iraq Body Count, who has worked with the group over the past decade. Here, Dr. Hamoziadou examines the number of Iraqi deaths in recent months and some theories about why the country has seen such a sharp rise in violence, while she expresses pessimism about an end to the violence there anytime soon.
The violence in Iraq has many aspects. One is terrorist attacks against civilians, which are indiscriminate. Someone puts a bomb in the market and 50 people get killed, anybody, children, whoever, Sunni, Shia, because you don't know who's shopping at that time. So there is that aspect. Then there is an insurgency, very clear insurgency. Those who want to bring down the government and have a different sort of state, maybe a Sunni state, maybe a Kurdish state, you know. So there is that aspect. And then there is smaller-scale revenge attacks. Killing entire families. We have had many such incidents recently where people go in someone's house and they kill a whole family. And no one really knows why the family was targeted, because no one really claims that, yes, they're behind this. At the same time, a new factor is what's happening in Syria this year, because there is an insurgency in Syria, a Sunni insurgency against the state. And that has made it easier for so-called al-Qaeda in Iraq to directly attack the Iraqi government. It goes beyond just sectarian violence, Shia and Sunni. There are many interests of several states and non-state actors in the Middle East.
What kind of numbers have you seen recently?
I compared the levels of violence between October 2012 and March 2013, and then April 2013 to now. And I found that the violence has tripled. In the first 6 months of the past year, we recorded nearly 2,000 civilian deaths. In the last 6 months, it's over 6,000. So since April, the violence has risen. Since 2011, when U.S. forces left Iraq, the Iraqi government has actually abandoned any efforts to include Sunnis in the government and the public sector, and Sunni politicians have been marginalized. And there's been great Sunni discontent in Iraq. And there have been protests throughout 2013 in Iraq, Sunni protests. And on the 23rd of April, Iraqi security forces actually attacked protesters and killed 49. And since then, the violence has risen steadily every month.
Is it true, then, that the majority of the violence is being carried out by Sunnis against Shiites?
Whether it is by Sunnis, we don't know for sure. Al-Qaeda in Iraq may be Sunni, but it's hard to identify terrorists, I suppose. But it is mostly against Shias, yes. Whether they are pilgrims targeted during festivals or agents of the state, such as police officers, politicians. Police officers are killed daily in Iraq, by the way. And this is more to do with insurgency than, you know, sort of classic terrorism. Anyone who is an authority figure, if you're against the government, you target.
Are police considered, they're not in the army, are they considered civilians or not?
Yes, yes, yes. We don't count the soldiers, but they are, I can say through my daily research, that they are targets also.
How does the death toll of military people compare to the death toll of civilians?
I don't have the figures for that, but it is much, much lower. Because others have done these counts or estimates, and they are much lower.
You sound fairly pessimistic about an end to the violence.
Nothing has really got rid of the instability and the insecurity in Iraq, whether it was outside interference or the movement of populations. There are people who left their towns because they were targeted and came back after 3 years thinking everything is okay now, and they were killed.
Do you think there are many Iraqis who would like to see some kind of outside intervention to help end the violence?
I think there are people in Iraq who now would like the U.S. to come back in, obviously not to attack and occupy, but to maybe help mediate between the Iraqi government and the people. Even Sunnis, I read recently, would like some kind of international involvement in Iraq's crisis, including the U.S., in a nonviolent way.
So does Iraq body count continue to go forward?
We do plan to continue our work because the violence is daily. I have been doing this work for years now, and I think in all these years there may have been 7 or 8 days that there was no there were no civilian casualties. So it is daily violence, and we take our work very seriously.
That was Dr. Lily Hamaziadou, a British-based news collector and recent events editor with the group Iraq Body Count. For more information on her group's work and the rise in violence in Iraq, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Since the rollout of President Obama's Affordable Care Act on October 1st, the health care reform law has run into problems, first with a technical breakdown of the program's national website, and then complaints about the cancellation of individual insurance policies that did not meet the new law's minimum standards for more comprehensive coverage. Not surprisingly, Republicans in Congress have focused attention on the troubled launch of the Affordable Care Act and have attempted to repeal or delay key provisions of the individual mandate that requires most Americans to purchase health insurance by March 31, 2014, or face penalties. In a recent press conference reacting to criticism, the president apologized to the American people for the troubled start of his signature legislative accomplishment and announced that his administration will let health insurers extend existing health plans on the individual and small group markets into 2014. Mr. Obama also acknowledged his disappointment that only 100,000 Americans had signed up for insurance under the new law in its first month, while assuring the public that a major push was underway to repair the website. 39 House Democrats, worried about the impact the troubled health care law may have on their re-election prospects in 2014, sided with Republicans on bills designed to hobble Obamacare. Your reporter spoke with Margaret Flowers, a Maryland pediatrician and former congressional fellow with the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who now serves as co-director of the social justice group It's Our Economy. Here, Dr. Flowers assesses what she believes to be the flaws of the Affordable Care Act that reinforces her advocacy of a Medicare for All universal health care system.
The Affordable Care Act was actually based on a health policy that came out of the right-wing think tank, the Heritage Foundation. And so it really is a right-wing bill that was passed under Democrats, and Democrats are supporting it. And so when we criticize this bill, you know, or when I have, people sort of say, oh, you're just feeding the right wing. And what I'm trying to do is just really tell the truth about it. And Kevin Thies and I wrote an article a few weeks ago in truthout.org called Obamacare, the Greatest Insurance Scam in History, because what we've actually done is we've taken the very industry that's a problem in this country, the private insurance industry, which it's created this very bureaucratic health system where a third of our health care dollars go into administration instead of actually health services, and the insurance companies are really they're businesses that sell insurance products for a profit, and so they're not really interested in health or paying out dollars for healthcare services, so they put a lot of barriers in place. And what we've done with the Affordable Care Act is we've taken hundreds of billions, if not trillion dollars, of our public money, and we're putting that into the very industry that's the problem. So it's overall what the Affordable Care Act does is, and I kind of hate to call it the Affordable Care Act because it's not going to be affordable care, but other people call it Obamacare. It's actually moved us farther in the direction of privatization of healthcare in this country. And so this whole public debate that's been around, you know, the website's not working properly and these other distractions that are used are missing the real point, which is do we want to continue to treat healthcare in this country like a commodity, like a cell phone or a car where you only get, you know, as much as you can afford? Or do we want to join the other industrialized nations around the world and start treating healthcare as a public good, something that everybody needs? And Obamacare puts us farther in the direction of a market-based or commodified healthcare system, and we need to go in the other direction, a Medicare for All.
Margaret, tell our audience how many people will be left out of this system owing to the limited scope of the Obamacare Affordable Care Act as intended.
Congressional Budget Office has most recently estimated that over 31 million people will still be left out with no health insurance at all, even when Obamacare is completely rolled out. And what we know from the state level is whenever states passed comprehensive, what they called comprehensive health care systems, and estimated how many people would be covered, they never met their goals. So I'm not sure if we'll, you know, if it'll be more than 31 million or not. It's possible. But in addition to that, the new normal in the United States is going to be under insurance. It's going to be people who are paying for insurance premiums, but then the out-of-pocket costs are so high that they're not going to be able to afford the health care that they need, and if they have a serious accident or illness, will face the risk of financial ruin and bankruptcy.
Dr. Flowers, are you concerned at all that if Obamacare fails, if the Affordable Care Act just doesn't succeed, that it'll be that much harder to move a more progressive universal health care bill through Congress?
Well, it's not, you know, if it fails, it's when it fails, because it wasn't designed to be successful in terms of resolving our health care crisis. It didn't really incorporate any of the basic policies that would address our, you know, soaring health care costs and our number of uninsured and our health outcomes. So it's when it fails. And again, it's if we want a progressive agenda in this country, which we haven't really seen for a while, you know, it's going to have to come from people organizing. And so that's why it's really fundamental, you know, starting to the goal of popularresistance.org is to help people see that our movements are connected, that actually, you know, that we who fight for healthcare or for a clean environment or affordable housing or education, we're all facing the same obstacle. It's this corporate-controlled government and this dysfunctional political system. And so, and all of our issues are connected. You can't be healthy if you don't have a clean environment, good education, you know, a house to live in. And so we need to work together more strategically to start to kind of shift and chip away at that corporate power. And then at the same time, we need to build up economic institutions that start to reduce the wealth divide and meet our needs, because our political system is really closely tied to our economic system. So as we develop a more democratized economic system, we will start to be able to develop a more democracy in this country. There are single-payer groups at the state level that are working really hard on this, and I advise people to go to healthcare-now.org and go to the page where you can look up what groups are working in your state and get involved. This is a real opportunity. And I think we should tie it to the austerity measures, to the cuts to our Social Security, because what we really should do in this country is expand Medicare to all, double our Social Security benefits so that we don't have a poverty retirement. And that would go a long way to building up the kind of social infrastructure that we need in this country.
That was Margaret Flowers, a Maryland pediatrician and activist who now serves as co-director of the social justice group It's Our Economy. For more perspectives on Obamacare from groups advocating a single-payer universal health care system, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.